We're in Bloomsbury, London, for episode 8 of season 2 of Travels Through Time, the podcast made in partnership with History Today, the world's leading serious history magazine. I'm Peter Moore. Today we're going to go back to the year 1764, a year remembered as one of bloodshed and confusion that changed the history of India forever. Many people have found the history of the East India Company astonishing. The writer Leo Tolstoy once wrote, "In wonder of the commercial company that enslaved a nation comprising 200 million people." But just how did they do it? Our guest today is going to take us back to the year 1764 to try and make sense of this riddle. That guest is William Dalrymple. William is one of Britain's leading historians, and over the past quarter of a century, he's published books that have won the Wolfson Prize, the Duff Cooper Prize, and the Kapuscinski Prize. Whatever the subject, though, the Indian subcontinent has remained a consistent fascination. Earlier this year, his latest book, The Anarchy, The Relentless Rise of the East India Company, was published. His aim was to understand just how the East India Company became an empire within an empire. It's a superb book. I caught up with William the other day at his publishers, and I began by asking him to tell me a little about the company's origins.
So I suppose the story begins on the 24th of September, 1599. Somewhere in South London and Southwark, Shakespeare is finishing off Hamlet, which is about to be performed at the Globe. But 20 minutes walk north from there, over London Bridge, a group of merchants have summoned a public meeting in the Founders Hall in Moorgate Fields. And a lot of grandees are there. There's the Mayor of London, there is a lot of the senior members of the Levant Company, which is one of the rich London shipping companies. But unusually, there's also quite a lot of ordinary people there. Well, we know exactly who's there, frankly, because in the British Library, there is the actual list taken at the door by a bunch of notaries. People who describe themselves as vintners, skinners, leather workers, and so on. In other words, small London businessmen. And the reason they bother to turn up to this meeting is that they're going to be given a chance to invest small sums of money, whatever they can afford, in what's clearly one of the most exciting financial developments in London's recent history. And the background to this is that the Levant Company had been shipping spices from Aleppo and Cairo and the Middle East, sometimes via Venice, sometimes going deeper into the Middle East and getting them back from the far Levant shore. But that business had taken the most spectacular downturn 3 years earlier, when the Dutch found that they could actually just sail around the Cape, head off to Indonesia and buy nutmeg, cinnamon and pepper direct from the producers at a tenth of the price. And they brought it back to Europe and sold it at a price that completely undercut everything that these London spice traders were doing. So when the Dutch sent a mission to London to see whether they could buy up any spare London shipping to mount a second expedition, the patriotism of Elizabethan London was roused, and a man called Customer Smythe, who was the head of the Levant Company, known sometimes as Customer Smythe because he ran the customs and sometimes as Auditor Smythe because he then became the auditor of the City of London, called this meeting to raise as much capital as possible to found a company which could do what the Dutch had just done, to go to Indonesia, buy or plunder or somehow get hold of spices, bring them back. And this was as risky and as difficult as, you know, a manned mission to Mars would be today. The last time the British had tried it, the fleet had ended up wrecked in the Moluccas, and the few survivors had sort of stumbled home on sort of flagging down passing ships, like sort of Robinson Crusoe. And so it was a high-risk venture. And for that reason, Customer Smythe decided not just to appeal to his 35 Levant Company investors, but to open it up to the whole city. And everyone would put in what they could. And the result was enough to launch the East India Company. They go off the next day to Deptford to try and find a ship. They reject a creaky hulk called the Mayflower.
Yeah, I've heard of that somewhere. It's a familiar ship.
I don't know what happened to that. But they do then go and buy a pirate ship called the Scourge of Malice.
Well, maybe that's a good point to leave them suspended.
Someone realises that it isn't a great advert dragon for the new trading company, so they rename it the Red Dragon.
Yeah, I love this this opening to your book, when you there's this idea that your neighbour, in neighbourly terms, we're talking about the Dutch, of course, are doing quite well with their trade, and they're doing so well, this is probably irritating to the English anyway, that then they're going to come over and borrow some of your ships so they can do even better. So they're kind of like driven into this enterprise by, I suppose, an obstinacy of,
envy.
We're not going to miss out, we're the great, well, they envy probably.
Jealousy, yeah.
And so through the 17th century into the early 18th century, you get this, I suppose, general growth, don't you? It's a very...
It's quite interesting. It's because what happens is that initially everyone's after the spices, and the Dutch basically win that round, and the British are driven out of the Indies, which means modern Indonesia. And famously, at the end of this, there's this swap where the Dutch are handed over the island of Run, which is where all the nutmeg comes from, which is the great prize in that ocean. And the English are given as a kind of sop a muddy island in the Hudson River called Manhattan, which in the long run proved not a bad investment.
Wasn't that part of someone's dowry, or is that a slightly different
story? That's a different one. That's Bombay.
That's Bombay, yeah. Okay.
But having lost, in a sense, the first battle against the Dutch, the English East India Company falls back on the next best option, which is the textile trade. And they want to trade in silk, chintz, cotton piece goods, which means large quantities of baled cotton, and the indigo with which to dye it. And the source of all four of those items is one place, India. So they fall back as the second choice on India as the centre of their enterprise. And it's an incredible piece of good luck, because actually what happens is that the spice trade diminishes, because, for example, everyone in Elizabethan England thinks that pepper is the Elizabethan equivalent of Viagra, and it's very quickly proved not to be to the default.
But a useful marketing device at the time.
device at the time, but also something that's quite easy to show actually has very little effect. And so for a variety of reasons, the spice trade doesn't actually crack up to be all it first appears to be, while on the contrary, the slightly duller market of cotton and silk turns out to have enormous possibilities. And the Mughal Empire grows as the company is growing to become literally the world's number one industrial producer of textiles. And it is the company that ships this all over the world. Mm. So much so that, for example, you get deindustrialization in Mexico because of the sheer amount of Indian cotton going over there. So the company, by pure default and good luck, ends up backing the right horse. Mm. And as the Mughal Empire grows to represent about 37% of world GDP, in the one time in its history, India overtakes China as the world's leading industrial producer.
This is about what time?
This is throughout the early 18th century. Mm. The Mughal Empire is politically beginning to get a bit ropey, but in terms of as an industrial power, it's reaching its peak. And the company is parasitical of this. It is the shipping agency which moves Indian goods around the world. And so as the Mughals grow richer and richer, so does the company.
I know in some senses this is an incredibly superficial overview of a very complicated story. So we've done quite well to get through what is essentially 150 years of early East India Company history there. But I want to go to the 1760s, which are a fascinating decade in so many dimensions, because we know this is the time of the Seven Years' War. It's coming to a conclusion in 1763-4. Some people talk about it as, well, it of course is the First World War, really, because you have conflicts sprouting up all over the place from the North American continent to Europe and
Philippines.
The Philippines. Yeah. But I think one of the sentences you finish off one of your chapters with, the place that was most changed by the Seven Years' War was not North America or Europe, it was India.
Correct.
So do you want to tell us what effect that war had on that place?
So the Seven-Year War is the great confrontation, or part of the great confrontation, between England and France, which will reach its final conclusion at Waterloo. And this is about, I suppose, the kind of third season of this ongoing soap opera. There's been the War of Austrian Succession, there's been the War of the Spanish Succession, now there's the Seven-Year War. And the Seven-Year War is a hugely different scale. It starts in the headwaters of Ohio, There's a lot of argy-bargy going on with the young Washington First Nation Canadian Indians rowing across Lake Erie, plundering loose British settlements lost in the woods of New York State. And all this sort of has huge repercussions globally. The war breaks out on mainland Europe. Hanoverian armies are going backwards and forwards. And in the middle of all this, there is a intelligence document which arrives at the East India headquarters in Leadenhall Street. And this intelligence document, like a more modern one, turns out to be complete fiction, or certainly in its essential detail that a large French fleet was heading specifically to Bengal. It was wrong. There was clearly a large French fleet, but it was going somewhere else. And as a result, two things happen. One is that the East India Company sends instructions to Calcutta to fortify itself, because they should expect an attack. And secondly, they persuade Parliament to send a task force out from London and to put in charge of these Marines Robert Clive, the guy who had already distinguished himself in earlier scuffles in the Carnatic. And Clive really is the central figure of this story. He's kind of punk from Shropshire, rural Shropshire, who was this restless youth who was had a gang in sort of on the Welsh borders, where he used to threaten to throw stones through shopkeepers' windows unless they paid him off, even on occasions lying in gutters and diverting water into someone's shop if they wouldn't give him what he wanted. And this sort of slightly sort of unsatisfactory, violent kid is quickly shipped by his parents off to India because he's clearly too moody for the church or the law. And twice he turns this innate violence on himself, tries to kill himself, doesn't succeed. And his moment comes when the French actually capture Madras. Mm. And in the months that follow, it turns out this guy's got an incredible capacity for soldiering. He's got no formal training of any sort. But in an age when campaigns are like sort of chess games with chivalrous meetings of generals and letters going backwards and forwards, Clive has none of that. He attacks at night. He attacks in the dark, kind of fog banks. And he's kind of a believer in a sort of 18th century version of Blitzkrieg.
Yeah, so you characterise him as a ruthless opportunist, is that?
But also an extremely effective one.
Yeah.
And he almost never loses a battle or miscalculates. He's very good at sizing up his battles.
But with that, does he have a technological superiority in terms of the weaponry that he has available to him?
He does. And the British and the French both at this point have all the fruits of Frederick the Great's innovations from the Austrian Succession War and the Spanish Succession. Like putting socket bayonets on advanced muskets, elevating screws on the back of cannons, horse artillery. Nothing that can't be easily emulated by other armies around the world. But it gives both the English and the French East India Companies about 30 years before the Indians catch up. And large Indian heavy cavalry armies, I mean, it's still slightly like Cressy or something in India. So, you know, it's all about heavy knights with maces and swords bearing down on the enemy. They have no answer to this new form of warfare. And so Clive, who's been sent out to attack the French, finds himself instead facing up a man called Siraj ad-Daulah, who's the Nawab of Bengal, who's taken against the British refortifying Calcutta against the French, though he doesn't know that, because they haven't sought his permission. And he just comes down, he takes Calcutta, destroys it. Now, normally, the East India Company would have had to have given some presents, opened diplomatic relations, and sorted it all out. But on this rare occasion, just as the news comes of the fall of Calcutta, Clive turns up with his fleet, and they just sail north, recapture Calcutta, knock out the French. And at that point, Siraj ad-Daulah's own principal banker, who's a man called the Jagat Set, reaches out and offers him £2 million if he'll do regime change in modern parlance, if he'll get rid of Siraj ad-Daulah and replace him with someone more amenable. There's this Arab general called Mir Jaffa who is appointed. And so what is regarded in Victorian textbooks as this great victory of British arms is in fact an act of base treachery between two groups of financiers.
And what capacity is Clive acting within there? Is he working for the East India Company?
Clive is working for the East India Company, but just to complicate matters, has a local commission from the British Army.
Oh, well, things are never very simple, are they? But I mean, this is the start of what we're going to get on
but
to.
But the important point is that almost all the big battles we're going to be talking about, particularly the big set piece of Buxar, is fought not with white British troops by and large. Mm. It's fought with local mercenaries who are called sepoys, who are trained up in these new infantry techniques by both the French and the British, often with money borrowed from local bankers. So the British pull off this trick. There's never more than about 2,000 British clerks in Bengal. And they pull off this trick of basically borrowing money from local bankers who are sympathetic to them as another financial, I mean, bankers talking to bankers, to train up mercenary troops to defeat other Indians.
Mm.
And it's amazing that they get away with it, frankly.
Yeah. Well, there's the other side of the story, which we're going to get on to in a moment, is the fractured political nature of what's happening in India at this time, because there's lots of different personalities which, when put together with Clive and the British, create this very unique historical context. But we'll talk about those in the context of these scenes.
As far as this period that we're talking about, 1764, is concerned, it's actually not that complicated. The Mughal Empire has diffused to its regional governors. So although the emperor is still nominally the most important man, sitting in Delhi or wherever in India he's wandering around, in actual fact, power has passed to his regional governors. And this is true in the south. It's also true in the area that we're interested in today, which is Delhi, Awadh, which is kind of central northern India, and then the incredibly rich eastern province of Bengal.
Mm.
And as we approach this crucial year, 1764, what happens is that the prince of Bengal, Mir Qasim, who's been defeated by the company, he's risen up against the company, he's been defeated by them, he flees back into Awadh. And there he forms a grand alliance of the greatest three Mughal commanders, the emperor, the Nawab of Awadh, and the Nawab of Bengal. These wow. three great Mughal armies into one enormous mass. And suddenly the company, rather than facing its usual scattering of piecemeal states that it can take out one by one, actually faces an extraordinary army of 150,000 Mughal troops.
Well, that's an incredibly visual, but I mean, 150,000 troops, what does that look like? You have to kind of leave that one to your imagination. This is in the February of 1764 when Mir Qasim, you say, and somebody else in particular are meeting. And do you want to tell us who these two particular characters are in general? Because they form the central characters in a narrative that we're going to follow through for the next half hour or so.
So there's three characters, and they're all fascinating characters in their own right. At the top of the pyramid is the Mughal emperor, Shah Alam. And Shah Alam actually is the central figure in this book. He's the one character that carries the whole story from the beginning to the end. We see him first aged 12 when Delhi's being plundered by the Persians, and this whole empire built up over a century and a half is collapsing visibly in front of him. And then poor old boy at the end of his days, aged 82, he's been blinded by a former male lover. He's the blinded king of a now illusory empire sitting in a ruined palace.
It's a horrible metaphor, isn't it?
It's a fabulous image. If you think of it filmically, I love the idea of this character. He starts off so optimistic. He's brave, he's handsome, he's a poet in five languages.
But he's there on this day in February.
He's there, and he is dubious about this, because the East India Company is very happy to be his ally and to operate in his name, because the company realises that this man, rather like the papacy in the European Middle Ages, has the kind of imprimatur of legitimacy and law and represents a sort of higher set of values above the scuffle of real politics. And the company rather hopes to make an alliance with Shah Alam and to use his name to hoover up more of India themselves. And Shah Alam knows this, so he is not at all convinced.
So he's not a natural rebel. Rebel's not the right word. He's not a natural opponent for the East India Company, maybe.
He is not a natural opponent for the East India Company because the East India Company understands that they have common interests with him. But this is not the case with the other two. The firebrand at the centre of this is this fantastic Nawab of Awadh, the governor of central northern India, based in a great city called Faizabad. And this is Shuja-ud-Dawla. And Shuja-ud-Dawla is this giant. He's 7 foot tall. He's got enormous projecting moustaches. He's said, still in middle age, to be strong enough to cut off a buffalo's head with a single swing of his sword and to lift up two of his officers, one in each hand. So there's this giant guy. And some of the more sophisticated historians of the time are a bit dubious about whether his intelligence matches his strength.
Well, I think it's his moustache which sticks in my mind. You say his old moustache projected from his face like a pair of outstretched eagle's wings.
He obviously was proud of his moustache, because in all the pictures you do see these moustaches just sort of oiling their way outwards like a pair of propellers. But the best historian of the time is this wonderful character called Ghulam Hussein Khan, who's been one of my key sources for this book. And he regards him as a slight liability, and I'll just read you a bit of what he has to say about Shuja-ud-Dawla. Shuja, he writes, was equally proud and ignorant. He had conceived as high opinion of his own power as he had an indifferent one to what his enemies could perform. And he thought himself more than equal to the task of conquering all three provinces, Bihar, Bengal and Orissa. Indeed, he had a numerous army with plenty of artillery, great and small, and all the necessary requisites of war, but no real knowledge about his means of availing himself of so much power. Yet he fancied himself a compound of all excellence and believed that asking advice would detract from his own dignity, even if the adviser was an Aristotle. He was so full of himself and so proud to have fought by the side of the Afghan warlord Ahmad Shah Durrani, who he had taken as a model, that when anyone proposed any advice on the mode of carrying on the war, he used to cut him short with, "Do not trouble yourself about that, just fight as I bid you."
Wonderful. He's a great dynamic character. Did we talk about Mir Qasim? I don't know. Well, because he's the third of these...
This trilogy of
warlords. Call them a band of brothers, I'm not quite sure. But the third of the characters is Mir Qasim.
And Mir Qasim is another extraordinary character. Mir Qasim is small, wiry, very bright. He is of Persian extraction, and he has persuaded the company to, in fact, appoint him as governor of Bengal after they get rid of the previous guy. He immediately moves his capital as far away as possible from the English in Calcutta and begins to rebuild the army, reform the revenue, and to the astonishment of the English, turn out to be a real ruler.
Yeah, reading your book, I was getting the sense there was a lot of admiration from you towards him.
Well, get that from the contemporary chronicles.
And from the contemporary chronicles.
Because there's an awful lot of duds at this time on the Mughal side. And
right.
Mir Qasim is almost as effective as Clive. Mm. He brings in a pair of Armenians to train up his troops. He copies the munitions of the East India Company, and he uses Western weapons against themselves. And he's really the first Indian ruler to realise that the sort of military bravado shown by the East India Company on the battlefield is not magic. Mm. It's just a matter of training and the right weapons.
And so if we think about this in the context of February 1764, is this quite a rare moment of accord between usually quarrelling or, factions which don't always have common interests? But for this moment,
it's an almost unique moment. And in fact, there's only one other moment, which is about 1780 to 83, when you have something called the Triple Alliance, when again, a whole series of Indian powers gather together to take on the company. But there's only two times it happens. And one of the things that allows the company to win through in the end is the fact that its opponents are often divided, and quite often the company is allied with one or other Indian faction against other factions.
Right, well, can we just do the descriptive history bit? Because we've done a lot of analytical stuff there, and it is 150,000 people, you say. Where exactly were they meeting? This is
So Mir Qasim, who's already been fighting the English and had a hard time, and has retreated back into Awadh, where Shuja-ud-Dawla is thrilled at the notion of a triple alliance against the company, and he welcomes Mir Qasim with a great hug, and throws this enormous durbar reception for him. The 6 miles away from the throne platform, troops are lining the roads in scarlet uniforms with their bayonets glinting. There are some fantastic descriptions. I'll just read. On hearing the news that the Nawab was coming to greet him, His Highness of Bengal had scarlet tents erected, in which he placed 2 Nawabi thrones. The cavalry and infantry lined the road for 6 miles, the officers dressed in their finest scarlet broadcloth jackets and sparkling new flintlocks. The Nawab vizier descended from his elephant and was greeted by His Highness at the entrance with all the pomp and ceremony. They exchanged greetings, holding hands, and mounted the thrones together. His Highness of Bengal sent to His Majesty 21 trays of precious robes and jewels, as well as elephants majestic as mountains. The Nawab vizier was impressed by the opulence with which Mir Qasim was travelling, and with all the desire of his enormous appetites, dreamt of extracting from the English huge sums of gold and all the riches of Bengal. He talked gently to his guest and commiserated his loss, promising help and seconding his demand that the English return his confiscated provinces. Then Mirkasim and Shujaudala went to wait on His Majesty Shah Alam, the Emperor, sitting as one on a single elephant, like a conjunction of two auspicious constellations, and proceeded in this manner into the royal camp.
Brilliant. I love that. That's a wonderful description. We're not going to improve on it at all. So let's go to our second scene, which is gathering momentum. They're actually going to do something with this pact that they have. But they cross the Ganges, don't they? And we get to May, the 3rd of May, when they have the combined Mughal army reaches the fortified walls of Patna. And they begin to lay siege. And now, do you want to tell us what this ancient city is, what the significance of it is, and why they are going there?
The combined Triple Alliance have first sort of gathered all their forces at Benares, the great holy city of the Hindus on the Ganges. And today we associate Varanasi, Benares with sadhus and sacred Hindu ceremonies. But on this occasion, it's the centre of the gathering of this great army. And all the different regiments are there. There's the Mughals with their cavalry, the Afghan Rohillas who previously fought with the Afghan Ahmad Shah Durrani, and they're dressed in long thigh-length boots and these fantastic long tunics. Then, the most exotic of all, there is an entire regiment of entirely naked Naga sadhus, who are the warriors, the traditional warriors of Hinduism. Although on this occasion they're fighting for a Mughal prince. and then there's a bunch, just to finally add to the confusion, there is a bunch of people in East India Company uniforms who are not in fact English, but French deserters who've been pressed into service by the company, run away, and they're under a sort of a soldier, a French Breton soldier of fortune called René Madec, who hates the English with a passion and regards himself as massively wrong. So you've got a bunch of Frenchmen, you've got some naked sadhus, you've got some Afghans on boots, and then you've got a huge body of Mughal cavalry.
It's a curious army, isn't it?
It's a fantastic army. And even Ghulam Hussein Khan, who is this very cynical chronicler, is impressed by it. But he also says, given their different allegiances and different religions, that there were problems. And again, I'll just read a little bit from him because he's such a wonderful writer. He says that fights broke out between the naked Naga sadhus and the Pathans, with entire platoons coming close to bloodshed. Meanwhile, rumours spread among the commanders that Shah Alam was in secret communication with the company. His Majesty was utterly opposed to fighting the English, said Ansari. So throughout these campaigns took no part in the deliberation or plannings, and during the battle stood by to observe his warring vassals from a distance. There was little order and discipline among these troops, wrote Ghulam Hussein Khan, and so little were the men accustomed to command that in the very middle of the camp they fought, killed and murdered each other and went out a plundering and a marauding without the least scruple or control. No one would inquire into these matters, and these ungovernable men scrupled not to strip and kill people of their own army if they happened to lag behind the main troop or to be found in some lonely spot. They behaved exactly like a troop of highwaymen, carrying away every head of cattle that they could discover. The plundering troops were so destructive that within a radius of 10 miles they left no trace of prosperity, habitation or cultivation, and the common people were reduced to desperation.
Well, we can imagine, like from a Google Earth perspective, this little dot moving
across the Ganges.
With a 10-mile radius of devastation around it.
And facing this man, facing this great army, is one Englishman called John Carnac. So John Carnac, faced with 150,000 troops of all these different varieties heading fast towards him, decides he's got no option but to fall back on Patna.
Yeah.
And Patna is one of the great commercial capitals of the period. It's where a lot of the bankers are based. It's the centre of the saltpeter trade, which is essential for manufacture of gunpowder. It's a very rich town. It's also got very effective walls. And Karnak knows this and decides that his best option is to go back to Patna as quickly as possible and rearm Patna, put up all sorts of new fortifications and outworks using the latest 18th century technology to do this. And he has 3 weeks.
Basically. And the numerical, differential is enormous, isn't it? There's 150,000
on the Mughal side and 19,000
on
Karnak's side. But Karnak, he's an engineer. He understands the importance of fortifications and how to build the latest fortifications. In France, in particular, there's been a lot of scientific study by a man called Vauban on how to resist the new armies since the age of Frederick the Great. And this means low walls with bantering walls that can't be destroyed by artillery. Very different from the sort of traditional massive Indian fortifications that rise vertically upright and are vulnerable, of course, to artillery fire. So Karnak has 3 weeks to get his act together and build everything that the 18th century defensive technology can arm him for. And he does very well. By the time that the Mughal army finally trundles exhaustively towards him, he's ready for them. And there is this battle before the walls of Patna. And Shujaudawla, the giant, goes straight into confrontation. He refuses to wait and he takes his favourite Pashtun Afghan cavalry straight into the march, and he rides immediately forward onto the walls, only to have this extraordinary barrage of 18th century artillery mince them down. And he then sends the naked Naga sadhus into battle, who likewise are high as kites on opium and hash and everything, and charge straight into the face of the guns, completely fearlessly, but are driven back time and time again. And he loses these two armies. Then he puts the French in, and the French can't get anywhere. And then he calls on his ally Mir Qasim to put his troops forward, and Mir Qasim falters. He won't do it. He's already faced the company twice before, and he's now so scared of company artillery that he just stays where he is. So nothing happens immediately, but this creates a major rift in the army, which later fatally undermines unity in the next big confrontation.
So just to, I suppose, characterise this confrontation at the walls of the city, it's completely fruitless.
It's fruitless.
For the army. There's no conquest. There's no significant losses in the East India Company army at all. What? I know with Mir Qasim, the story gets quite strange with him, doesn't it?
So Mir Qasim is now everyone's least favourite Mughal commander.
And that is because he failed to act at a decisive moment.
At this crucial moment.
Yeah.
And Shujo is badly wounded but continues to fight him. He's incredibly brave but just not very bright, poor old Shujo.
They're a wonderful contrasting pair, aren't they? You've got the swashbuckling guy with the great moustache and the clever, small, Svengali-ish.
Yeah, exactly that. And anyway, so this rift in the command now becomes apparent. But what Shuja doesn't know is that Karnak has fortified this place brilliantly, but has very few supplies. And if Shuja had the patience, as Mir Qasim tells him, just to sit down behind fortifications to besiege Patna and to let time erode the companies, because they have a whole city in there without supplies. Shuja is too impatient for that. And he says, I've had enough. And he marches off to his winter quarters, where he summons the dancing girls from his capital. He summons his pigeons, which he loves playing with. He summons all the pleasures of Avad. The courtesans, everyone, to the despair of Ghulam Hussein Khan, this very bright chronicler, pleasures himself for the entire winter. And then when spring comes, the company goes on the offensive. A new regiment is marched up from Calcutta under a completely ruthless and very brilliant Highland commander called Sir Hector Munro.
Yes, let's get on to him. Can we deal with, I suppose, when is the time to deal with Mir Qasim, is it now? Because there's a moment when he feigns madness, isn't there? I think this is when he's lost his prestige. He's in the tent, he's having many accusations meant against him. This is a man of enormous power.
And he's come into Shuja's dominions with enormous quantities of treasure, which are hidden in harem carriages. Yeah. And these carriages, according to traditional Muslim propriety, are closed carriages because there's veiled women. But by the time he's been in the camp for a couple of months, people have realised that there's no one coming in and out of these carriages and are highly suspicious that these harem carriages actually contain solid gold and all the wealth he's brought with him from Bengal. So this increases the temptation of Shuja to take action against him. And in the middle of the winter, amid all the parties and the notch girls and the dancing and everything else, he wins over Mir Qasim's ruthless German commander, a man called Samru. And Samru arrests his own boss, Mir Qasim. And Mir Qasim dresses up in a fool's outfit and sort of feigns madness and is basically just locked away.
You say in the book, or you write in the book, I should properly put it, in the space of a few months, Mir Qasim had transformed from being one of the richest and most powerful rulers in India to become Shuja's shackled and penniless prisoner. This is all completely cinematic, isn't it?
If that doesn't get Netflix signed up, nothing. Yeah. We can get retired.
It's a Netflix original series.
Yeah.
Our third scene. We've seen the great coming together of the armies. We've seen what is an abortive first attempt at military success. But really, and this is difficult to underplay as a significant moment in the history of the Indian subcontinent, 22nd of October 1764, the Battle of Buxar. What happened at the Battle of Buxar? Who is involved and how does it go?
So Shuja is still having bowling parties and pigeon parties and nautch girls and playing around when one day in October, to the beat of regimental drums, the redcoats of the 1st Battalion of Company Sepoys can be seen marching through the mango groves along the banks of the Ganges. And more importantly, shadowing these advanced regiments are the company barges. And the company moves all its ammunition and all its supplies by barge at this period. So behind these waves of drummers and sepoys come these sinister-looking barges full of the latest weaponry, fresh from Britain. And the leading French advisor in Shuja's court is an aristocrat called Gentil. And Gentil takes one look at what's happening and realises that they've got to move quick. And he says to Shuja, listen, it'll take the British a whole day to unload their weapons, to build their initial fortifications and their entrenchments. Attack now. Attack this minute while they're unloading the barges. Mm. And you can get them on the run. And Shuja says, don't tell me what to do. I know how to fight a war. All he does, in fact, is send his girlfriends back to the capital and get everything ready. The next day, the English go straight into an offensive mode. They march forward towards Shuja. And Shuja, again, very stupidly, leaves his fortifications at Buxar that he spent the whole winter behind and says, I'm not going to be frightened by a tiny army of company soldiers. Mm. And he marches out of his prepared entrenchments and goes immediately into the command. And initially has rather incredible success.
Talk at this point, though, about Munro, because one side of the battle, I think we've characterised really, really well. But Munro is a kind of typical character from this time, isn't he? He's Scottish.
His family have fought on the wrong side at Culloden.
Yeah.
And like a lot of Highland chieftains, he's getting back into favour by going off to the colonies and proving himself a loyal citizen.
Quote of his, which I think tells you a lot about his personality that you've got in the book, regular discipline and strict obedience to orders is the only superiority that Europeans possess in this country. That tells you a lot about his personality, doesn't it?
He's very much that. He's regimented, he's disciplined, he likes everything in a straight line, so he lines all his guys up. And Shuja, who's a sort of chaotic but rather sort of gallant character, sends his Afghan cavalry to entirely encircle the small company army and attack it from the rear. And this does the trick. They attack the back of the thing where the weakest regiments are, all the reserves flee and run. And then fatally, they leave the camp empty. And so the Afghans, who can never resist a good plunder, leave the battle and go straight into the camp and begin plundering all Munro's treasure, try and find the women, they try and find this, they try and find that, and they leave the battle. Meanwhile, Shuja has assumed that he's actually won the battle. He actually sounds the trumpet of victory, and lots of his commanders come from the wings and sort of give his congratulations. There's quite a few British prisoners already been taken who are brought in bound, and he laughs at them. And at this moment, Munro, who had tried to retreat but realises that he's now entirely surrounded, can't even get to his barges, decides that the only thing for it is to risk everything in one last frontal assault on the wings, where the commanders had actually vacated their spots and gone to congratulate the commander. So Munro himself leads this sort of fabulous charge.
And I think we can't really underplay this again, can we? Because as you write it in the book, I'm not sure how well regarded this is in the context of general historiography of India, but as you read through the book, this strikes me as a real turning point in Indian history, this particular charge.
It is an unbelievable turning point, and what we'll hear in a bit is how much, I mean, this frankly hands the whole of North India to the British, this charge. Gentil has the best account of it. Gentil is there on the field. It seemed as if the English were completely beaten, he wrote. They had lost their ammunition and food stores, as well as all their baggage and the treasure for military expenses. Munro, having recognised his own defeat, sent orders for the supply barges to approach the battlefield as soon as possible, as the English army had no option but to retreat by the river. But there was a long delay in carrying out these orders, and meanwhile the Mughal cavalry was busy pillaging the English camp, instead of harrying the enemy and giving the English no respite. Seeing this, Munro, having lost everything, made a desperate charge against the troops of our left wing. By this bravura act of desperation, Munro became the master of the battlefield, which he believed he'd been forced to abandon only a few moments earlier. The company had already started to retreat, and they would have fled had they had the means, but because they did not have any way of escaping, they plucked up their courage, and seeing our left wing towards the Ganges was understaffed and unsupported, they charged it with a reckless bravery that had few parallels.
Yeah, you call it a short and confused battle, really. A bloody one, absolutely. More than anything, though, it was significant. It changed things. So if we're looking at this, I suppose we started off in about February time with the triumvirate coming together. Then you have the next 6 months, 7 months, we get to October. This is really the end, isn't it, of so this particular
there's no coming back from this
mini arc of history.
The whole point of this triumvirate was to, in a sense, summon all the Mughal armies and to take on the British.
And expel the East Indies.
And expel the company once and for all. And when, to everyone's surprise, the company, which has initially been crippled by mutinies and is unprepared, well, the company actually wins this battle at Buxar. There's nothing else keeping it from conquering North India. And this totally changes the rest of history. The company, which has come to India as a needy series of adventurers, is suddenly transformed into the masters of the richest country in the world. And then, just to emphasise this again, this is not the British government. And these are not, by and large, with a few exceptions, British government troops. These are the private security force of a company based in one office in London, under what's now the Lloyd Building. It's not commanded out of Downing Street. It's not the British Army, the Regimental Army. It is the East India Company's private security force.
I mean, this is how you put it right at the beginning of your book. It's a wonderful encapsulation of what you were just saying, so I'll repeat it now. It was not the British government that began seizing great chunks of India in the mid-18th century, but a dangerously unregulated private company headquartered in one small office, five windows wide, that's a wonderful detail, isn't it, in London, and managed in India by a violent, utterly ruthless, and intermittently mentally unstable corporate predator. We're talking about Clive, of course. And Clive, we mentioned him at the beginning of this, and he's now going to come back at the end, because I suppose history is happening in all different places at the same time. So whilst we've been in Bengal, meanwhile in London, in Leadenhall Street, these, you know, kind of, there'd been messages coming back, 8 months or so it takes for messages to get from India to England, and there's been messages that there's an army, there's rebellion, there's trouble.
The share price is sunk.
Worst of all, the share price is sunk. And Clive, who had until this moment been just, I suppose, becoming part of the English establishment, or the British establishment,
buying country houses and so on,
etc., has been redispatched, and he arrives now. So the concluding
he arrives in Madras, and as he arrives in Madras, someone hands in this letter saying the Battle of Buxar has just been won, sir. This Triple Alliance is destroyed, we are masters of India. And Clive's first reaction is not to write back and say, well done, chaps. It's to send an urgent message in cipher to his banker, telling him to mortgage all his properties and buy East India Company shares. In other words, what we today would call insider trading.
Yes, he would have done quite well in about 2006, I imagine.
Well, absolutely. This is absolutely kind of city malpractice in its in its purest form. And makes a third fortune through this, because the share price does indeed go bonkers. It absolutely goes through the roof, and Clive can buy Powis Castle in Herefordshire.
But I suppose what we're getting towards is the concluding part of this little mini narrative, because I mean, it's a big book that tells the entire history of the company, but we've looked at this, you know, this 1 year. But it ends almost with a bit of a full stop, with something that happens in 1765, which is really...
So this is a thing known to historians as the Diwani, which of course doesn't mean anything to anyone here or in India anymore. But what it actually is, in modern terms, an act of involuntary privatisation. Because having captured the Mughal Emperor, Shah Alam, who's actually played no part in Buxar, he stood by and watched, he is compelled by Clive to sign a document which hands over the administration of the three richest provinces of the Mughal Empire, Bengal, Bihar and Orissa, which has 1 million weavers and is generating all the cloth that the company has been selling so profitably for a century, to hand over the entire administration of this region to the company. So instantly, the whole nature of the business is transformed. Up to now, it had been the same as all Western traders trading in India since Roman times. Pliny the Elder complains that Roman ladies have this taste for Indian silk, Indian diamonds, and Indian sandalwood, and as a result, all the collected gold and bullion of the Roman Empire is bucketing into India. The same is true in the 18th century. All this cloth, all this silk, all this indigo, all this opium, there's nothing particularly the Indians want from Europe. And so there's been this drain of wealth from London into Bengal. From the Diwani, from the moment of Buxar, from the moment that Buxar is won, the drain of wealth heads in the opposite direction. Mm-hmm. Because now the company has the right to tax and extract land revenue from India. And after they've deducted the costs of the army and occupation and everything else, the profits could be used for buying the silk, the gins, the opium, and so on. And they need not ever again send any ships of gold and silver out from Britain. But just by taxing Indians, they can buy the goods they need to sell in Europe. So this is a business model that is just going to increase the profits of the company beyond the imagination of man. And when you go today to gorgeous country houses around Britain with beautiful Palladian pediments that look as if Colin Firth might stride out at any moment with his cotton shirt and breeches, those quite often are built on the profits made in this quite brief period after Buxar, when the company is just literally minting money. It has the right, with the Diwani, to mint money.
And there'd been nothing like this before in history, had there? I think at one
point...
It's
a company. It's not the nation. A company has conquered an era. And companies are genetically primed to just make maximum profit that regulators will allow them to make. In India, there is no regulation. What happens next, of course, is that the company screws up because it's just too greedy, and it asset strips Bengal so badly that the next thing that happens is the Great Bengal Famine. And it's like a dust bowl. Bengal, this incredibly fertile, rich, prosperous land, is reduced to ashes and starvation, and a fifth of Bengal starve 5 years later. But all that's in the future. As far as everyone's concerned, at the end of this extraordinary year, the company has gone from a bunch of needy adventurers to the kings of Hindustan.
Well, that's a wonderful way to characterise the story. It starts off with a very prosperous, front-footed trading company, and ends up with something which is quite staggeringly different, powerful.
It moves from an empire of business to the business of empire.
Well, I can't improve on that description either. William, can I ask you one last question before we let you dash off into the London night? I always like to ask this of people. In fact, if you could bring anything back. We've been talking about 1764. Is there anything you'd like from that time to have on your goat farm just outside New Delhi, is it?
That's well, it may sound a bit venal, and perhaps it's the result of having read company records solidly for 6 years. But at the end of 6 years, I've more or less bankrupted myself writing this book. Okay. So I'd be very happy with one of Mir Qasim's abandoned treasure chests left on the battlefield of Buxar to take to my farm if I was given the option.
Well, there we go. Well, we shall magic it up. Thank you very much.
If only that was that easy.
thank you very much for travelling back with us today. It's been a real pleasure talking to you.
Fun.
And it's a brilliant book.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that conversation. That was me, Peter Moore, talking to William Dalrymple at his publishers in London. William's book, The Anarchy, The Relentless Rise of the East India Company, is available in hardback now.
Hello, I'm Artemis. I hope you enjoyed listening to this tour through the year 1764 with William Dalrymple. If you'd like to learn more about the themes that we touched on in this episode, then there are loads more articles at historytoday.com. For example, you can read India versus the East India Company by John Wilson, who shows that violence and expansion were an integral part of the company's armed bureaucracy. For more about Robert Clive, Richard Cavendish's article, The Battle of Plassey, examines that crucial moment in Clive's early career. And for something which explores later implications of colonialism, you can have a read of Anna Maguire's article, Colonial Encounters, in which she discusses how the First World War threw together people from all over the world. You'll find links to all of these at historytoday.com, along with much, much more from the world's leading serious history magazine. Thanks again for listening to today's episode. We'll be back again, as ever, in a fortnight. But from us, for now, that's it. Goodbye.